Well, it feels a bit like a fraudulent occasion because I feel everybody's very familiar with. I mean, I don't write that much, not an epic of me. I'm sure you've probably all heard it all before. So what I'll probably do, but it's a nice occasion for me to say goodbye to you all. There's great tears in my eyes. Thanks for your fun and friendship and guidance throughout the year. What I've been doing while I've been here is mostly research. First of all, on Jonathan Martin, the incendiary, prophet, pamphleteer, poet and painter, who set fire to York Minster. And more recently on the Jarrah March, which is a radio documentary I did for... And the Jarrah March wasn't a radio documentary. for radio in 1976. Well, come in, Australia. Well, come in, Thomas. Yeah. See, we started too early.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm probably going to do that as a book now. In fact, I am, using a lot of the pictures. So I thought I'd better do a bit more research than I initially did when I did the program originally. It was an hour's duration, and it was limited what we could do in that time. And the most revealing thing that came out of that for me was coming across a journalist called Guy Waller, who was a very young man, in 1936, fresh from Yorkshire, but late teens, early 20s. who was working for the Shields Gazette, the North Shields Gazette, and Jarrah was his pitch. And he gave a very moving account of the town and the decline of the industry. In fact, the murder of the town, as Ellen Wilkinson rightly described it. But he also told me about something I didn't have, you know, I didn't have the facilities to follow up at the time, which in fact is being here has allowed me the facilities in a sense, because the materials that are in this library here, and because it's on the doorstep. But anyway, there was a fascist, very strong fascist connection in 1936. The story of Jarrah, briefly, is that it was a one industry town apart from St. Bede founding it. I think they say Bede founded it, Palmer made it, and McGowan buggered it. McGowan was the lead of the NSS, National Shipbuilding Securities Limited, which was a gang of capitalists who got together and rationalised with the blessing of the government, which meant cutting out a powerful competitor, i.e. Jarrah, and that was the principal industry of the town. Built up of many generations. It was the only town in... it was the only yard, in fact, in the world in which you could have iron ore coming in one end and ships, battleships, coming out the other. It's increasingly relevant, I find, with 1.5 million unemployed. However, there was also one possibility for saving the town. They had something like 80% unemployed. And that the steelworks... There was an American who wanted to build a new steelworks there or introduce new machinery. And he was told he couldn't. He bought options on it. It was a steel magnet, American steel magnet. The facilities were there and the skills were there. And unfortunately, he had to contend with an organization called the International Steel Cartel, which was principally a European German based. Cartel of steel magnates who had an organization which limited the amount of steel that could be produced per annum by any country or any company, and if you exceeded that amount, I can't remember how much it was, 100% of your profits were forfeited and divided equally amongst the rest of the members. What that in effect meant was that Germany was obviously rearming and constantly overproducing. And are you coming in?
Yes.
Oh, come on. And subsidizing British steel manufacturers not to produce. Now, they were also getting a grant from the government to produce steel, and grants from the Germans not to produce steel. And they said the reason they gave not to allow the steelworks to be built in Jarrow was that Runciman said, who's chairman of the Board of Trade, said there was no market for any steel. Come in, Dan. There was no market for any steel that would be produced in England. But in retrospect, looking at the figures, we were the year he said that, importing 1.5 million tons of steel per annum from Germany. And what this journalist pointed out to me, and he took a lot of finding, was that he thought there was a fascist connection, that the International Steel Cartel, there was a lot of high-placed British industrialists who in fact were deliberately running down British industry to the benefit of German industry. So after some time, in fact this year, I managed to get a list of the Anglo-German Fellowship, which is pro-Nazi, English pro-Nazi organization, which had amongst its members some very, very prominent and very, very powerful people, of whom I have a small... They resigned this organization about 4 weeks after we declared war on Germany. And I've recently got the list, and it's very difficult to find out about these people, so I've been spending weeks sort of my head buried in this sort of index in the library, the indexes of the obituary columns of the Times, to find out, and then looking them up on microfilm. But there's a small pattern emerges from something like, I don't know, 1/16 of the people I've been able to look at. They're all very powerful people, landed gentry, earls, aristocrats, but also very powerful business people. What my job is to find out what all of their connections were in the 30s, i.e. were they members of banks which were subsidising the British steel manufacturers who prevented the Jarrow steelworks opening. Right, so, and that seems to me, those cards are falling very quickly, neatly into line. But interestingly enough, they seem to have a few things in common, like like Sir Andrew Agnew, for instance, was chairman of the Petroleum Board during the war, an important position, and also a commandant of the Civil Guard. Sir Thomas Moore was a Home Guard joint parliamentary committee dealing with the affairs of the Home Guard and involved in its formation. Aaron Thomas, CBE, was commanded Home Guard Anti-Aircraft Regiment and Lieutenant Colonel in that. And Lord Londonderry and various other persons of that ilk. There's a very small sample. So they all, and like Earl of Airlie, in fact, was Commissioner for Civil Defence in Scottish Region, plus being Chairman of the North of Scotland Hydroelectric Board. So you begin to get a sort of pattern which is emerging. And this is all kind of work in progress, because I haven't got anything new apart from my research to give you. Is that it's not like Dad's Army. It doesn't appear to me to be like Dad's Army, but so much as had the Nazi boot landed in England, there's a lot of people in very top positions prepared to cooperate. And I don't think we would have noticed, really. I mean, there wouldn't have been many heads rolled. Most of them seem to be in position. One other thing they had in common was a love of discipline. It's quite often a lot of them in Parliament later, I found, agitated for corporal punishment. and frequently lamented the lack of discipline amongst Britain's youth. One particular is the Earl of Airlie, who was the father of Angus Ogilvy, present husband of Princess Alexandra, or one time husband, I know that's still current. Who, and I'll quote to you from the Times obituary for 1968. He, as I say, was on this list. He was a Nazi sympathiser and active Nazi sympathiser in England and was part of this club. Quote, and as I said, chairman of the Scotland, during the war, the Scotland Hydroelectric Board and deputy regional commissioner of the civil fence, Lord in Waiting to George V, Lord Chamberlain to the Queen from 37, etc. Quote, fiery critic of lack of discipline in Britain's youth, on one occasion in the House of Lords in 1959, told how years earlier he had ordered a battalion of Highland infantrymen to lower their kilts after hearing rumours that some men were wearing, quote, unmentionables underneath. The men all obeyed, but he said if he had given the same order in 1959, he probably would have been sued. And the Times goes on in all instance. But to many people of every sort, it will not be only the respected and admired public figure, nor the devout Christian whom they will remember best. It would be the gay and gallant Joe. Kilted and bonneted with a joke and smile for everyone. So, I was rather delighted with that. then amongst that crew, main bogeyman was Lord Londonderry. Well, Londonderry features for me. Londonderry, probably you know, but in case you don't, is of the Castlereagh family. Castlereagh, of course, the man from Shelley's Mask of Anarchy. I saw murder on the way who wore the mask of Castlereagh, wasn't it? And the man whom Lord Byron, whose grave Lord Byron wished to piss on. These people occupied principal positions in the newly formed Ulster government, Northern Ireland government, on behalf of the Minister of Defence and so on. But Lord Londonderry and Lady Londonderry, Lord Londonderry wrote a book called Us and Germany, or We and Jack, I can't remember what it's called now, and was a great admirer of Hitler and Goering. And those people. He was also, as well as owning many land, great areas of land in Northern Ireland, was also a large mine owner in County Durham, and his family is hated there. In 1810, his family, he occurs in a poem of mine, well, his predecessor anyway. In 1810, his family sort of committed incredible atrocities against, brought in troops and slaughtered miners and gained the hatred of the Durham and Northumbrian miners. he wrote this book suggesting that we, in 1838, I mention him in relation to the Jarrah March because his he owned Seaham Harbour, which was a constituency for Ramsay MacDonald. And I have two photographs. Which I'd like you to look at, and I'll pass it around in a moment. I think he obviously owned Ramsay MacDonald too. I'll quote you something from what Lady Londonderry, Marchioness of Londonderry, wrote about Ramsay MacDonald in her memoirs in 1838. MacDonald loved beautiful things, books, pictures, beautiful women, and lovely jewels and colours. And she also goes on to say, towards the end of her book, in retrospect, in her conclusions, she says, and these people, you know, all of this is important to the northeast of Jarrah, to what that's all about. She says, what the rising generation will have to face, she's again lamenting the lack of discipline amongst the youth of England. One should always be suspicious of that. quote, what the rising generation will have to face, it seems to me, is that without faith in something, something deep, something real, nothing in life will be worthwhile. The more positive isms are taboo, like Nazism or fascism, because they imply doing something. And then she goes on to complain about the pinkos, pink boys, and getting digs, I think, indirectly at Ellen Wilkinson, who was the MP, Labour MP for Jarrah at the time, and who in fact said that if a war did break out with Germany, that Londonderry and others like Lord and Lady Reachdale, who were also part of this Anglo-German fellowship and were parents, of course, of what's she called? The Mitford, which one? Yeah, well, of course, the parents of all of those people. But they were also active. And she ends her book with this vision. She says, of course, England's full of contradictions, and in less than a decade, she will most likely be laughing at herself for the pink thoughts and her pink boys, and all will be marching along, armed to the teeth in the cause of peace. Women territorials as well as men, air women as well as airmen, vanguards and air guards, as virile a race, again, as ever existed, and confessedly proud of being citizens of British birth. Even more extraordinary things have happened than this. On this note, I end these reflections in the month of October 1938. Well, here's a picture, and as I say, Ranald MacDonald was, his constituency was Seaham Harbour. Seaham Harbour was actually owned by Londonderry. Londonderry wrote a book called Ourselves in Germany, and there are two pictures on this, which I'm passing around, which amused me. One is from the one with the most familiar figure on it, is from Lord Londonderry's book, and the other one's from Lady Londonderry. Can you pass them around? Pink on. Go to the back of the class. I don't know. Humanitarians. Anyway, I put Rand MacDonald in a sort of particular light, along with other extinct creatures. Kind of fun. So having said all that, I think I'll read you a few of the poems from the Jarrah March sequence. And I suppose the connections, they've said that Concert will be the Jarrah of the 80s, those of you who've heard of Concert. And I suppose the connection there really is that this new guy employed by the Tories has been brought in not so much as a businessman, I think, because he's isn't he actively involved in anti-trade unionism in America and those that new slick union-breaking executive briefcase-carrying crew. I forgot what they're called. Anyway, I'll read you a poem from that. The Bishop of Durham accused the marchers of being of the march, in fact, of being revolutionary mob tactics. In fact, they had no option. They were continually conned and fooled and tricked and very possibly the subject of a conspiracy. And the Bishop of Durham accused them of revolutionary mob tactics in a letter to the Times. The day that appeared, they got a very cold reception. I think it was in Wakefield and had to sleep in a deserted church. Shaking off damp sleep, and this is to Hensley Henson, who was then the Bishop of Durham. Shaking off damp sleep in a deserted church, 3 years deep in the consecrated dust, scrubbed clean of holiness, God no longer lives here. A dull dawn through decaying columns, morning stoves lit on the gravestone. A small flame gives warmth against your chilled indifference. They breakfast well in hell's kitchen. Cobwebs obscure the windows. A pulpit damp, rat-shat and rotten, crumbles in the hand and is forgotten. Here is an organ which once sung, distilled the rank air with its leather lungs. Traces of its decorations glitter, cherubs, angels, piped a holy lilt. Rust, neglect, decay, all served a dull disguise, deny its guilt. There were a lot of eminent clergymen and bishops and so on in this pro-Nazi organization. I'll read some more from that. David Riley was the organizer, or one of them. David Riley stands upon a small platform beneath the banner, Jarrow Crusade, in letters larger than a man's head. The characters are made from their bodies. The words are printed on the sky. His arm is raised and says, I will not be broken. His mouth is open and says, I will not be stopped. His shoulders are straight and say, we shall not bend. His eyes are wide and say, we shall not close. His legs are firm and say, we shall not buckle. His feet are steady and say, we shall not tire. A small boy beneath him, hand on hip, a mask lifted from his face. Him, he too, he says so. The petition box, the dog, Wee Ellen, the band, march through an elegant suburb. The small dog's tail is held high, and it's only the beginning, only the beginning. I should read you this. In fact, the dog, which they nicknamed Paddy, adopted itself to the march, and they took it as a mascot and gave it a badge saying Jarrow Crusade, Jarrow March on it. And a lot of, most of these poems, except the first one I read about to the bishop, in fact, describe pictures. So next time you invite me here for a poetry reading, I'll bring my slide projector and we can look at the pictures. A man and dog, the mascot, a thin chiseled chin, hair combed back for the camera, and cap flat, crouches on his hunkers, holding a dog to be snapped, a small mongrel which adopted the march. One hand holds a forepaw, the other, for inspection, a crusader's badge fixed to its collar. The dog is well held and happy. I think I didn't publish these ones in the book, but I'll read them anyway. Portrait of a Crusader. Asleep across a line of sandbags, a newspaper cast aside, reread. In his pocket, a letter from home, blankets wrapped and tied in the corner. A bright light makes the room more alien. He's alone for the moment. Though they came as a body, unity their name, to, quote, preach the gospel of Jarrow's misery by the wayside, unquote. Each man lives his own life. They are not made of stone. Dinner time. This again describes a picture of them having a break. And Ellen Wilkinson, who became the, I think she was the second lady cabinet minister in the Labour government after the war. She was education secretary and responsible, largely responsible. Was it the 45 Education Act or 46? Was it? I'm getting that through. She died, I'm not sure, she may have committed suicide in 47 or something. But she was very much respected and loved and worked really hard there. And Jarrow wrote a book called The Town That Was Murdered. Dinner time, pies, sandwiches and mugs hot with tea, relaxed and chatting, some men laughing. It's obvious to see they're all together. Wee Ellen enjoys her sandwich, but enjoys more the man second on her left who pulls her leg with casual grace and makes her laugh like a woman. She sits in the midst of her men. Pioneers, oh pioneers, bread and water of the Holy War. I'm not sure what laughing like a woman was. Actually, the quote at the end, pioneers, oh pioneers, bread and water of the Holy War. Pioneers, oh pioneers, not as obscure as you might think. The Chopwell Lodge of the National Union of Mine Workers. Their banner, do you mind about the window? I'm not going to jump, it's all right. It's not when it's raining. They have, in fact, a wonderful banner. For me, that was all pretty much part and parcel of the region and its history, which is a history of radicalism. But they have a banner with Keir Hardie, Karl Marx, and Lenin, I think. And Workers of the World Unite. Plus, quotation from Whitman, pioneers of pioneers. What's the rest of that? I've forgotten. Anyway, so that was a kind of side reference to all that. Tired, miserable, homesick, depressed, reading a newspaper, lying on sandbags. This is a private moment. the small hut for tonight's kip, homely enough, a print of Malay's peasants reaping, and a stone floor to sleep on. No one looks at the picture and its neat frame, with its peasants stooped back and working. Interestingly enough, when they went to Sheffield, when they got to Sheffield, the Conservative agent, in fact, it was a Conservative mayor, I think, of Sheffield. This is a quotation from his speech. You've been told that you will not be received by the powers that be when you reach London. Well, to the devil with that, I say. I say this march is a good thing, whether my head office likes it or not. There is one thing I like about it, and that is that politics do not enter into it. Sure, you got that, eh? There can be no politics when people are fighting for their bread and butter. From the bottom of my heart, I wish you every success. You have brought to the notice of the people, not only of Britain, but of the whole world, that you are fighting for the right to work and the means to live. That's interesting, isn't it, coming from a Conservative Lord Mayor? I think that was probably the last of those poems. And a portrait of a crusader. Cap off and a spotted bandana around his neck. He mingles in the crowded street, his badge, his royal cape across his chest. Who are these men from the north, grey-faced and clear-eyed, family men, hunger dancers? And it ends up, actually, with... we ended the radio programme with a quotation from a man called... Oh, Christ, I've forgotten his name. But he was, in fact, one of the directors of Palmer Shipyards. And he was continually giving the alternative point of view throughout the programme, saying that people didn't really suffer and £2 a week, it didn't sound like much, but he had £2 a week and he ran a motorbike and, you know, could eat an Elden grill of steak and all the rest of it. Did quite well, but he didn't have a family or anything. But he this was his opinion, and there's a lot of truth in it. I wasn't aware of it at all, that is Jarrah. I think it was a great mistake, the march. Jarrah wasn't any worse off really, except it was in one area than elsewhere, you know. It did bring it into prominence. You see, now it's like the Irish and the Battle of the Boyne. People who had nothing to do with the march still think of it. It's passed on from one generation to generation, which is a great mistake. You should forget the past and look to the future. Well, we followed that with Alan Hull's song, which was Now It's 1976, Politicians Play the Same Old Tricks. Can anybody tell me what has changed? March on Marshal Riley's army. Well, they're still marching on, a bit younger. What's the time going? You haven't got any beer in this tin, do you?
Yeah,
I have a bit in there. Okay, that's a bit of a Jarrah march. I'm quite happy to do a very bitty evening. Alright. Has anybody got any requests? Fuck off.
Pardon?
Okay. Already a few of the newish poems. They're not that new. Now, in fact, I think I'll read a story, a bit of prose that appears in something called Not Poetry, which I think Chris Sugden very nicely has in his bookshop. So that, okay.
Yeah, I think I still have a few
more. Yeah, didn't matter. this is from a book, which book of prose, collection of stories, which is called Custom and Exile. You don't know if I've read it before, do you? I mean, it's about being on a train in a contest and all that, you know? Oh, right, sorry. Anyway, the action is, up to this point, this section is called Footlust for reasons I'm not sure about. The hero is on a train going across Europe, having escaped from England, and wakes up having gone across the, travelling through Poland, across the Berlin Wall area, waking up on a railway station in Poland, having drank a litre bottle of whiskey with the Russian sleeping car attendant the night before.
Everything is moving backwards, and I am no exception. Putting, and also there's various characters, I mean, who suddenly creep in. The Contessa is a lady who got on in middle-aged, very elegant lady, who catches the train as it's moving out of the station in Amsterdam. No, where's the port? Den Haag, or? Can't remember. Anyway, one of the stations in Holland, and has her baggage thrown on the train, and she just gets on, glutting a bottle of Napoleon brandy. Everything is moving backwards, and I'm no exception, putting myself and myself between the eventual destination. A small railway station on the way to Warsaw, the vast, flat, central European plain. Right. That way, huh? Shall I ad lib until you've changed your tone?
That's silence.
Go on, we wait. The vast blow. It's raining and has been for days now. A young Australian's papers are not in order. He needs to wait for the next train while obtaining a visa. At first, when I noticed him on the platform, he looked about 20, a heavy, bulky rucksack at his feet. As I leaned out the window to look at him more closely, it became apparent he was old. He had stood there for a very long time and was gazing longingly at the train. That was the morning of my second day on it. As we moved slowly out of the station, I waved and said goodbye. He nodded, hands in his pocket, as though he'd never take them out again. He does not recur in this journal. Head out the window and the sun shone. I was awake. There's nothing to compare with moving through the landscape of an unknown country. I was awakening from... This was where I wanted to be, moving. Thin woodlands, fields of sunflowers, crude industry, small squat houses. On the top bunk I feel tranquil. The train moves gently and the landscape opens like a flower and closes like a fist. I'm glad to be out of England, but more than that, this life of motion unrolls memories like a carpet. There is only one thing spoiling my fantasy of spending the rest of my days in this moving study where I would read books, write endlessly and lie back, allowing the past to entertain, amuse and educate me. The flaw in my story is a character I have so far failed to introduce. You can get his name and address off me later. He is a tall American with a mustache somewhere between Groucho Marx and Marlon Brando playing Zapata. He shares my travelling compartment, which is as disturbing for him as it is distasteful for me. As I staggered in, bleary-eyed, he was aware my bed had not been slept in the previous night. Did you get what you wanted last night? I remained silent. There was no way I would gratify his purient appetite. A guard came in to check our papers and passports. Jesus Christ, he's the second one this morning. I think I've lost my chance of sleeping. I won't imitate the American accent. Everything is apparently in order. The American tries to sleep. The door flies open. And the Contessa, looking bedraggled, falls in. My bottle of brandy has been stolen. She looks threateningly at the American. Don't look at me, lady. She looks my way. Hello, darling. Why have you come back here? Give me a cigarette. I give her a packet. She sits on the American's bunk and says to him, give me a light. He turns on his side to face the wall. I'm trying to get some sleep, lady. Sleep? She hisses contemptuously. He addresses me. Do you think you could carry on this conversation outside, man? I begin to discover a distinct dislike of him. The more of his nature becomes apparent, the more it irked me. You're doing all the talking. Nevertheless, it was too crowded in the compartment, and it would be better with at least one less person in it. The Contessa stood and loomed over his prostrate body. So you don't want to give me a light? She was obviously still drunk. We had proved to be very good bottle pals. Now I had a great need to dream and wanted to be left alone. And the American stood and bumped his head. She stood aside while he, pajamaed, reached into his coat, which had fallen onto the floor. His hand was in the pocket and he got out the matches. Opening the box, attempting to strike one, it fell apart. He tried another, it also fell apart. The Contessa mumbled something in German, which defined her impatience and described her disgust. Hey, man, they're wet. I sensed panic in his voice. So's my jacket in the floor. He looked down at his bare feet, the toes of which were oozing amidst the tufts of damp carpet. In a short, swift leap, which revealed his squeamish nature, he landed on his bunk. Christ, man, you didn't piss there last night. His voice appealed for reassurance. I did not feel inclined to give it. Where's the water coming from? I need a light, said the Contessa, indicating incredible boredom with the situation. I was losing patience with her and didn't want the compartment to stink of tobacco. It was also overcrowded. Look, I'll see you later. She turned her large, surprised eyes towards me. The mascara had run riot. Her lipstick was smudged. It appeared she could not focus properly, and it occurred to me that as far as she was concerned, the party was only just beginning.
You may see me later, young man, but as for your companion, who cannot even oblige a lady with a simple light for an ordinary cigarette, he will not see me later. I do not wish to intrude where I am not wanted, where the matches are wet and the floor is soggy.
As she rambled on, I felt the situation was getting out of control. So did the rest. For God's sake, lady. From the tone of his voice, I gathered he was in a state of great frustration. I myself found it difficult to remain calm. This was far from the peace and composure I'd anticipated for the rest of the journey. As Eus was expostulating with the Contessa, I could see her becoming more engrossed in the mannerisms of this blustering paranoid. She had sensed his weakness, and looking at him, mumble.
Do not bring the name of the Lord into your unwashed mouth.
Look, lady, I'd like to clean my teeth and shave and sleep if only you'd leave me alone to do it. She moved two steps towards him. The sound of the water coming between her toes was audible. I lay back and closed my eyes, expecting to hear. Instead, there was silence, and having no clock, I was unable to ascertain its duration. In this situation, there was a certain security. She was too pissed to climb the top bunk, and I was too exhausted to get down.
God damn it!
The bicycle was standing by the roadside. It was a sleek racing model and light. The wheels shone brightly. Each spoke reflected its own individual sun. This was reassuring. The saddle was large enough for two. It was situated in a long and thickly wooded lane. Tall trees formed a high roof, and rhododendron bushes grew in profusion out of the ditches on either side. In bloom, the flowers were red and purple, then great explosions of white. There was no doubt the vehicle would convey me with speed. Mounting the bike, I sat astride two silver discs from which emanated sharp needles of blinding sunlight. The handlebars were immediately adjustable. Their position changed with my mood. At first, I had approached the bike tentatively, and the handlebars were irritatingly high and wide. Then, as I sat upon it, my mood shifted gear smoothly, and the outstretched handlebars curled forward in perfect synchronization with my spine. They curled together into a liquid machine, and set like a frozen flower. In this fetus position, we moved off down the road. I barely heard the birds singing. A warm wind whispered half-revealed secrets into my ears. One long, enduring gust claimed to contain Mozart's dust. Minute cinders peppered my ears. Laughing, I decided never to wash them again. With no other traffic on the road, I sat back and relaxed. The handlebars in tune with my mood straightened up, allowing my eyes. I heard the manuscript workings of the magic flute and gained so much momentum that we sped unnoticed through a border checkpoint, shot unseen across a frontier. The border post was relaxed, the guards standing idly by the roadside like insolent cowboys. I pedaled freely into a medieval city square. The sound of cathedral bells celebrated some occasion in the Christian calendar, and people sat relaxed and chatting at cafe tables. I climbed off the bike and walked amongst them. They spoke a language unknown to me. The bicycle followed close at my heels like a loyal and loving horse. We approached a small and narrow doorway leading into what I imagined was a cafe. Inside, small groups of people stood looking at the exhibit. Some industrious academic had discovered the private dream diary of their national literary hero and had produced an exhibition of images derived from the pages of his tormented sleep. In it, expectant persons had wandered around his interior chambers, gazing at and deriving immense pleasure from charts and graphs of the electrical impulses generated by his brain while dreaming. It was a remarkable vision, come to fruition after two centuries. A feeling of terror came over me as I gazed into the first exhibit, which was a mirror. The bike appeared at my side and I mounted it. We rode reassured through the liquid glass. With great relief, I sat back in the saddle and breathed the cool apple-scented wind which blew along the narrow lane in which we were riding and which led into another smaller and more private square, backed on one side by a castle and on the other by the cathedral. Some private houses made up the rest of the square, and from one of these ancient buildings a tall blonde girl wearing a long blue dress came out. The cathedral clock struck the third bell of midday. She looked around her. The square was empty apart from myself and the bike. Tall wooden scaffolding against the cathedral cast shadows of geometric patterns, making the symmetrical surface of a games board across which she walked. "How do you know you love me?" she said. This was our first meeting. Dejected by her apparent inability to perceive the infinite in an instant, I travelled to the centre of her eye and in its reflection saw an acorn lying on the ground at our feet. In answer, I put the seed into the palm of her hand. Her fingers closed around it. Her large, widely spaced eyes took me into them. I could see all the square, the ornate details of the rooftops. A maidenhair fern quivered on the slight breeze of an open first-floor window. In her eyes, I saw myself take her hand to my lips and then watched her mount the bike behind me, putting her arms around my waist. So the day turned to clear night and identified Orion, the North Star, the plough. All maps and atlases had been confiscated years ago. In her left eye, I studied a chart of the heavens and identified a course we might navigate. Her gentle breath at my ear seemed to propel us. Where our flesh divided and became separate, I could not tell. Border guards leant against a frontier post. They belonged neither to one side or to the other. They possessed and protected only the divide across which none may pass. Harassed and frustrated, we turned aside and followed another course, came eventually to the lane in which I had first found myself. The bike came to rest beneath a tall, wide oak. We dismounted and looked up. I helped her reach an overhanging bough and held her legs while she raised herself onto it and looked down from amongst the canopy of leaves, her pale green eyes. She passed me down a scented handkerchief. It smells of apples and is with me still. "God damn it, woman, will you please leave the train?" The Contessa was in no mood for uppity Yankee imperialist arguments. "No one can leave the train when it is moving unless they are thrown, fall, or jump off. Which of these do you think will be employed in my departure?" "Oh God, I meant the compartment. I paid for it for privacy." "With what currency could you hope to achieve that?" She didn't hear his reply. "I paid in dollars. The coin is yet to be minted." Because of the tone of her voice, which was unbelievably sad, I turned over and looked down. She sat on his bunk and gave shelf room on her face to an encyclopedia of tragedies and a cosmetic manual cut up and served as a cubist clown. Her red nose was a beacon of despair. Her swollen lips danced upon her chin. Each eye told a lie of the other. I gazed at her from my bed. The American said. The door flew open and mine host came in, speaking to me in fluent, overhung Russian. Lifting his chin, he drew a thick finger across his throat, then pointed at me. I shrugged my shoulders apologetically. He shook his fist and started laughing and backed out the door, laughing, leaving it open. "Well, somebody close that fucking door," said the American. Two curious people plodged by in the corridor outside. "How did the corridor get flooded, man?" U.S. asked. Ivan reappeared with a steel tray, which he put on my bed. There were steamed potatoes in one dish and bits of cooked beef in another, presumably to heal the damage done to my stomach. Just as I was about to express my gratitude, the Contessa screeched at him. "It must have been you, the bottle of brandy." He responded by demanding she leave the compartment. This was all done by gestures. She would have none of this and hurled a torrent of abuse and accusations at our host. I did not understand the language, but still I felt embarrassed. The venom and contempt came out of her pores like sweat in a Turkish bath. I was getting very hot, and the windows were steaming up. The potatoes were good. Ivan was not to be so easily daunted. He left the compartment. "Thank God the racket is over. Now maybe if you left, lady, I could get up and have a shave." U.S. had obviously smelt victory. Before the Contessa could synchronize her vision with her hearing and speech motor, the door burst open again. A custom man entered. "All right, any hashish, whiskey, guns?" He staggered slightly. "I will take the whiskey now and have the rest later." She rarely missed a cue. "I'll have to search your luggage. Please open the back." I was travelling light, but the American was prepared for a blizzard, a drought, a flood, food poisoning, a famine, piles, and a coming out ball. In fact, I had first heard of him in England, arriving fresh off the boat with a tea chest of toilet rolls brought all the way from Slippery Rock, Massachusetts. The drunk's custom man had a lot of studying to do and not much space to do it in. He was not aware of the wet floor, which left US in a state of panic as he stooped to retrieve his dropped possessions. Ivan came into the compartment with a policeman and pointed to the Contessa, who was curled into a corner of the lower bunk. Ivan and the policeman spoke rapid Russian to the Contessa. US was only dimly aware of this further officious intrusion, as he was too absorbed in the drunken customs man's mangling of his goods. "This tape recorder," said the customs man. "A present from an admirer," replied US modestly. "It's true." "And what do you intend to use it for?" I was only able to gather snatches of their conversation, which was beginning to sound like an interrogation. The Contessa, meanwhile, was stubbornly refusing to return to her quarter of the train.
"I am not returning from here until someone returns the bottle of brandy and the $300, which have also been stolen."
The customs man, having left US's goods in a heap on the floor, attempted to squeeze past Ivan and the policeman. On the way, they had a short and amiable chat. When he left, US said, "Thank God he's gone. The son of a bitch really gave me a going over. What the hell's happening now? Who are these guys?" They, the policeman and Ivan, both looked at him together. Here was this overfed American on whose bunk there sat this drunken half-dressed woman who should have been at the other end of the train and whose presence here was an ongoing threat to the good name of the railway company. She was obviously in no responsive mood, but he, on the other hand, on whom the responsibility was coming firmly to rest, could quite easily be persuaded to do his duty as a citizen. All of this must have been written large in their eyes, judging by his response. "Now look, she's nothing to do with me." "But she is sitting half naked on your bank." "I am, aren't I?" She turned to the policeman. "Do you find me attractive too?" She leant over and caressed US's leg.
"Did you find the brandy, darling?"
US looked shocked.
"You must take this lady back to her own part of the train. You should not have brought her here." "I didn't invite her."
God, it's terrible enough doing a Geordie in English accent, American, Russian, Polish, and German. "Yeah, well, we? Oh, yes.
I didn't invite her. I'd be pleased if you took her away."
The Contessa rose like a cobra.
"Oh, so then you have made a plaything of me. You have grown tired. You throw me aside."
US appealed to me.
"Will you tell him what happened here, man? I'm getting very tired of all this."
The policeman had no time for dubious witnesses and barely gave me more than a glance. I turned to Ivan, indicating my boredom. He was sympathetic, but was obviously determined to see the Contessa, who must have wounded him deeply, off the premises. The policeman said,
"I think it would be better if you both came along to the guards van and answered some questions. Perhaps the lady wishes to register a complaint, make charges."
The Contessa rose majestically to her feet. She never refused an invitation.
"This is insane, man. Are you coming along?"
US said to me. "No, I think I'll stay here and enjoy the quiet for a while. See you later, I hope." As we left the compartment, his expression of injury and self-righteousness was turning to panic.
"I don't even speak Russian or Polish or any language you understand."
I gave him the bowl of meat. "They'll probably get an interpreter at the next station. Shut the door after you." I took out my copy of The Third Policeman and opened it between the pages of 91 and 92 and snorted the line of coke I had packed into the crisply tight-bound volume. It was a great book, but I couldn't afford to read it as I didn't want the binding to work slack. The same copy turned up for me in Brixton and I enjoyed a couple of crystal chapters there. Hey, I think we're finished there, shall we? Done an hour. Has anybody got any questions or requests or would like to buy me a pint? Me going away at present. quickly, I'll just read you. This is just a short bit of the transcription of the. Ha ha! Caught the archive. But Jonathan Martin, who was, I told you earlier, was an incendiary. He was a very poor man, a very religious man, and he had a lot of visions. If anybody of you know the paintings of John Martin, the epic painter, do you know him? If you look at them, we've got a book in the library. Someone at Tate. These great sort of biblical scenes. Yeah, Upturning Mountains. The Great Day of His Wrath and all titles like that. It's incredible, epic. Cecil B. DeMille type painter. Well, his brother Jonathan used to have visions very much like John's paintings. But that principle, they were probably caused because he was starving. I mean, he was. Anyway, he didn't like the clergy, and not many people did then, apart from the clergy. And these are extracts from his autobiography. He wrote a short pamphlet, which he rode around on a donkey selling it. And he says, about this time, he'd been nailing anti-clerical notices to the church door, just saying, the sword of judgment is at hand, because he thought the clergy were they were public school educated, and he didn't think they believed in what they were saying. He was part of the Primitive Methodist and Rant movement, and that tradition, which was very popular, as you probably well know, at the turn of the century and during the Industrial Revolution, Blake being the tail end of all of that. Well, not exactly a tail end. About this time, the Bishop of Oxford was to hold a confirmation at Stockton for the Bishop of Durham. I had heard that he was a good man and that members attended his visitations. I was glad to hear a good report of him and resolved to try his faith. I visited my brother William, the anti-Newtonian philosopher and inventor in Newcastle, and borrowed an old pistol from him. I laid it, he took it home, and he decided it was tied together with a string, and I thought he'd test the bishop's faith. And he came home with this old pistol, and his wife said, "What's that, Jonathan, for God's sake?" He says, "What are you going to do?" He says, "I'm going to shoot the bishop, what else? If he's so good a man, and eminent a Christian, he'd not fear death." Says Jonathan, a bit naive. So he carried on the story. He said, "I laid it down carelessly, determined if she should remove it and I should receive no encouragement by a dream, I would proceed no further in the matter. When I got up in the morning, the pistol was not to be found, and there I thought the matter dropped. When I entered Stockton Church to be confirmed, I was astonished at the wonderful size of the bishop, and said, 'Surely he hath drunk a great deal of wine for his stomach's sake, for I never saw so corpulent a man before.' Some officious persons hearing of it told the clergyman of Norton, Mr. Anstey, and he laid a complaint before the magistrate against me. A vestry meeting was then called, to which I was summoned. My previous interference with the church was urged against me, and so much was I tormented with questions on the subject before I went to the vestry, and while there, that I was considerably agitated and off my guard. However, the reverend gentleman was little better tempered than myself, and showed a degree of rancour that I did not expect. Now, if I had intended to hurt the bishop when he laid his hand upon my head, could I not, like the treacherous Job, have plunged a dagger in his heart, saying, 'Art thou in good health, my brother?' Or like the left-handed Israelite who said to the king of Moab, 'I have a message from God for thee.'" And the magistrate says, "Mr. Martin, have you a gun with which to shoot the bishop?" "I had no intention of harming the man and meant him no injury, though I considered you all deserve shooting, being blind leaders of the blind leading your flocks into the ditch. You say that you lost the gun," and these are clergymen, of course, "and so far no one's found it, but if you found it, would you really have shot the bishop? I would ask him some questions out of the creed, and if he did not answer me satisfactorily as to his conversion and the evidence of the spirit, he must be branded as a deceiver of the people." For this, he was confined to a madhouse for life by the clergy, who were also the magistrates. Right, so that's that. Then he spends a lot of years there. I'm just going to read you his charge, where he's indicted in court. These are either his writing or transcripts of the trial. He spent something like 4 years in lunatic asylums for paupers, which were
atrocious, and conditions which were incredibly atrocious. The Metropolitan Commissioner for Lunacy, Commissioners for Lunacy in 40-odd censured these particular three particular lunatic asylums, two of which he happened to spend his 4 years in. And he was treated very, very brutally and escaped once and returned to the magistrates because they gave him, the first keeper, it was very brutal at first, then a new keeper came and treated him well, considered him sane and testified to that effect, four times tried to have him released by contacting the clergy who had confined him to a lunatic asylum, and saying that he considered him sane and gave him the key to go about the place and so on. And so in his innocence, because he was given so much freedom, he escaped and wanted to visit his friends in Northumberland, and decided, well, he had the key, go and see the magistrate and say, look, here's the key, and they trust me so much with the key, they don't think I'm insane, so can you just take the dogs off my back? And of course they said, well, for your pains, you know, you can go back, and they put irons on his legs and this time, and he did escape again after 4 years, during which time his wife was dying with cancer of the breast, and they would not allow her to visit or his son, and suffered atrociously for no crime that I can find. Anyway, he eventually says fire to York Minster. He's persecuted by the clergy continuously because he shouts his mouth against them. But he eventually, I don't know, his wife dies and he comes back and sets fire to the Minster. Which he did warn them. I mean, I'm not justifying that anyway. He did send them nail letters to their door saying, you know, your fine buildings, quoting the Bible, how your fine buildings will fall about your head and everything. As they indeed did. And so when he's indicted, it reads like this. I'm just kind of charmed by the blog. I like his visions, his dreams impress me a lot. He was, everyone who knew him, who gave testimony, including the jailer who kept had him in prison in York awaiting trial, wrote a glowing report of him to the gaffers of Bedlam, where he ended up and died. He was a very harmless man, never actually inflicted harm on anyone. So I find him kind of charming and amusing. So his defence, or the defence put up by his brother, and he employed Brougham, who later became Lord Brougham, didn't he? Oh, what's what I'm doing? You know, the guy who wrote about horses and carts and that. And the defence was insanity. But the clergy, the prosecution, i.e. the church, had to prove that he was sane. Which is rather ironic when they had in fact imprisoned him for life for being insane like 5 years previous to that. So the clerk of the court says, Jonathan Martin, you stand indicted for that you, the said Jonathan Martin, late of the township of Minster Yard with Bedden and the liberty of St. Peter of York and the city and county aforesaid, labourer, on the first day of February, 10th George the 4th, with force and arms at the township aforesaid and the city and township aforesaid, unlawfully, maliciously and feloniously, did set fire to the cathedral church of St. Peter of York, there situate, against the form of the statute and etc., and against the peace of our Lord, the King, his crown and dignity. What say you, Jonathan Martin? Are you guilty or not guilty of the offence by this indictment laid to your charge? 'Twas not me, my lord, but my God did it. It is quite common for him to punish to the third and fourth generation and to show mercy to them that fear him, to keep his commandments. You are also charged with feloniously stealing a quantity of crimson velvet and gold fringe, and the two gold tassels, the property of the Dean and Chapter of the Cathedral and Metropolitan Church of York. What say you, Jonathan Martin? Are you guilty or not guilty of the offence by this indictment laid to your charge? My God gave me that for my hire. The Lord gave me the silk to make a robe like David the king, and the velvet to make a cap, and the tassels I took from the pulpit to hang down over my left and my right ear. Are you guilty or not guilty? I had it given me for my hire. We will take that as a plea of not guilty. You will be tried tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Very well, my lord. And then finally, he gives an interesting account of himself. He's led by dreams, he says. The real story, of course, is untold, except unconsciously in the trial. And this is a little from his speech when they said, would you like to say anything? And he said, what, in relation to burning the mist in the Lord? I said, well, yes, that. I think he was a trickster, you know. I think he was a joker, as much as anything. And being very naive as well. So he wrote these letters, which were incredible. And he talked about roast beef and plum pudding and stuffing themselves while he and his peers, of course, were suffering starvation and were kind of all millennialists, kind of worried about that shift with the Industrial Revolution. And so he says that he sent a lot of letters to the clergy, nailed them to the, and in fact more or less forewarned them, and put his name and address, signed the letters, your sincerest friend, Jonathan Martin, 41 Ardwark, York. I mean, you know, so he said, I was anxious to hear from the clergymen and to speak to them by word of mouth, but none of them ever ventured to answer my letters. I petitioned and prayed to the Lord as to what I was to do after that last letter. At length I dreamt there was a wonderful thick cloud came from the heavens and rested upon the cathedral. And then it rolled over and rested on my lodgings where I slept at. When I found it come, I awoke and wondered what it was and what it meant. And I was told by the Lord I was to destroy the cathedral on account of the clergy going to plays and balls, playing at cards and drinking wine. I thought I heard a voice inwardly speak. Excuse me. Informing me that the Lord showed me the visions of the dark and thick cloud to point out the propriety of setting the cathedral on fire, and that I should make it shake and tremble, and that it was fulfilling the will of God, as in the latter days, according to the prophecy of Joel, that God would pour down his spirit on all flesh, that the old men should see visions and the young men dream dreams, that there should be signs in the heavens, blood and fire and vapors and smoke and so on. I found that this was to be a fulfillment of the word of God. I had that so impressed upon my mind that I had no rest either day or night. I found the Lord was determined to have me show this people a warning to flee from the wrath to come. Anyway, that's John. We're finished.